I'm Cameron Harold, the founder of the Second in Command podcast. Really quick, before we jump into today's episode, you need to know about two important ways that we can help you and your company grow. Number one, check out the COO Alliance. It's for COOs, presidents, VP ops, or whoever is your company's second in command to the CEO. The COO Alliance is the world's leading community for the second in command, and it gives COOs the tools and connections to grow themselves and the company. Head over to COOalliance.com to learn more about our members and the results, the program, and our 10x guarantee. If you qualify for membership, you can set up a complimentary call with our team to discuss if it's right for you. I'll tell you about number two in a bit, but first, let's start this week's episode.
The way that you process and how you think is good enough, and you don't have to look to other people for answers all the time. You can figure things out. That's pretty important. And I actually say that to my managers too. I say, all the answers we need are in this room. You just have to figure them out. I call that expertitis, that people get scared of their own thoughts. They get scared of owning the consequences of their thoughts.
Welcome to the Second in Command podcast, produced by the COO Alliance and brought to you by its founder, Cameron Harold. In the Second in Command podcast, we talk to top COOs who share the insights, strategies, and tactics that made them the chief behind the chief. And now, here's your host, Cameron Harold.
All right, we've got a great episode today. We have the COO for Dr. Bronner's on the pod. I have wanted to get Dr. Bronner's as a brand on the podcast for about 4 years, finally made it happen. Michael is the COO of Dr. Bronner's, a really interesting, unique brand. I've also loved their label and what it talks or how it talks about the company, the marketing, the messaging. One of only a few brands that actually uses their label in the way that Dr. Bronner's does. He's worked for the company for 18 years, which is super unique for somebody to grow up inside of an organization, was with them when they only had 35 employees. Now they've got 350 and are definitely a household name. Their company, Dr. Bronner's, got the highest B score in the world and actually going off the charts. You're only supposed to get a score of 200 as the cap. They hit 207, which has got the whole B Corp organization world up in arms trying to figure out how they even made that happen because they ranked so highly. They have everyone in the company on the same benefits program. He's going to talk about how they moved from being a family business to more of a professionally run organization, how they use postmortems to actually decide on what new systems to put inside of the company. You'll love this episode. Make sure that you share it. Make sure that you subscribe. And also take a look at it on our Second in Command podcast YouTube channel. We'll see you on the inside. So, Michael, welcome to the Second in Command podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, looking forward to this. I have been a fan of Dr. Bronner's for years, got exposed to the company, gosh, roughly around 10 years ago. I was Canadian. I don't know if you had a bigger footprint in Canada or not. I know you do now because I see it everywhere, but I don't know, or maybe I was just living under a rock and didn't know of the brand. But you've been with the company for 18 years, which is also highly unusual for a leader. So was Dr. Bronner's big in Canada, or did it just become that? Or and maybe walk people through it if they're not even aware who the brand is.
I don't know how long the brand has been in Canada. I know that when I came on board in mid-2005, that for Canada, we had a much smaller distribution. We had several outlets, mainly the health food chains, and we used to put label overlays by hand on the primary display panel, and we would just pull those stickers off and put them on so that it met the 101 requirements for Canada. And so that was Canada was our first international market. And so my guess would be about 30 years, but it took a while to get into national distribution.
Makes sense. So that's probably why I didn't hear. But so yeah, 101 is the Quebec legal requirements for having all of the labels in French and English is kind of part of the issue. So was that harder for you as a brand? And I helped build a couple brands into the Quebec market, and it was sometimes extraordinarily difficult and then other times frustrating. Was it a good entry point for you in testing your international expansion in Quebec, or would you leave that one till later now?
I can't comment on the actual sort of international marketing side of it. It was good for us to need to up our game as far as label granularity. goes, so that we didn't just have a single label for a single bottle. That difficulty actually made us better because it taught us how to do it elsewhere too. Because we used to have the little labels that we'd stick on, and then we went to full labels. And then after enough international markets, we actually designed a database simply to have label variants to track all of that over time. Dr. Bronner was, he was famous for changing the label constantly. He would call up his secretaries in the middle of the night and have him change a section of the Moral ABC, and then it may or may not go to print. And so ask us what the label looked like in 1983, no one knows.
Right.
But maybe around 2010, 2011, I designed the label revision code so that both for management and for posterity, we would know what labels went out with which bottles, thenceforth. It's the idea of when's the best time to plant a tree, an oak tree 20 years ago. Second best time is today. And so I just kind of drew a line in the sand and said, we need to know all this now. And it made us, and it gave us a lot of international capability with a coding system that was designed.
Now, you guys have done something pretty unique with your labels. There's only, I don't know, a handful of brands that I can even think of that have gone this far with their labels. But your label is a huge component of your marketing. It's not just the name of the brand and, you know, the ingredients. You guys have got stuff in there around the story and core values. And can you talk us through some of the thought process behind the label? And does that go back to the founder, or is that something that is?
It goes back to Dr. Bronner. I'll try to keep it in the 2-minute version because this is quite a subject. But Dr. Bronner was a third generation Jewish German soap maker. And he saw part of his family perish in the Holocaust. He left in 1929, left Germany and came to the States. And so he didn't leave specifically because of Hitler, but the factory was Aryanized in around 1937, 38, very procedurally done, the letter and all that. And he saw what happened to his family. And so the Moral ABC is the writing all over the bottle, except for the PDP, all the legal stuff. But all the stuff you think about with the Dr. Bronner's, that was Dr. Bronner's sort of overall philosophy. And he was in different places in the States, but when he finally arrived in Los Angeles, he would literally stand on a soapbox in Pershing Square, talk about the Moral ABC. He was a soap maker. He would give people bottles as thank yous for coming. And then people would take the bottles and leave and without waiting on what he had to say. And so he started putting his writing on the bottles. So he had a captive audience. You're standing in the shower, you read the bottle. And so that was Dr. Bronner's sort of existential reaction, both to sort of the micro version of the horrors of World War II, but the macro version of the bomb and the possibility that humanity would be wiped out. It was his contribution to the world. And so there have been a couple of things that we've changed over the years, just sort of legal imperative. We changed them. But it's more or less Dr. Bronner's sentiments and words unchanged as much as possible, still in there. We call it our trade dress, and we call it an apothecary look.
And it is an apothecary look. It's interesting. It also, like, it reminds me of the Lululemon bags back in the early days, the red bags that had their company core values and statements and phrases and mantras kind of all over it. And it begot a bit of the cult-like following. Dr. Bronner's has got a bit of this cult-like following. And I think of cult-like culture in a really good way. I don't think of it as the Jonestown stirring the Kool-Aid bad cult. Can you speak a little bit to that kind of culture around Dr. Bronner's? And does it carry past the marketing into the internal part of the organization?
It does. I think what I want to say is that we're centered set thinkers. We're trying to get to something. Dr. Bronner was trying to get to something, but back in the early 70s, he had to get his bottles from 1-800 Sketchy Bottles or Us. No one knew anything about what was in the plastic in the early 70s. No one knew about the supply chain. Everything was completely opaque. He did the best he could by formulating a very clean soap and running a good company. Now we have taken that. Now we have traceability beyond what Dr. Bronner could have imagined all the way back to the farm. We're fair trade certified now. Our bottles are 100% PCR. We were the first ones to do that 21 years ago. And so we've taken whatever is on the label and given it feet and really made that work. And that's been our brand promise over time, not just what is used to be what was in the bottle. And then it was what was what the bottle was and what the label was. And then it starts to go upstream and downstream so that everyone who makes, everyone who is involved in our value stream makes a reasonable living off of it. That's our, that's being fair trade certified there. We have the highest B score in the world, theoretically not possible, but I think we got a 207 at our last audit, and you're not supposed to be able to get above a 200. So you asked about marketing, but who we are and what we do, the fact that you can use a clean product that's a good value, it's concentrated, so it takes, so it actually lasts longer than other products. That's all part of the brand promise, and people are able to buy into kind of a capitalism 2.0 when they use our products.
Okay, you just kind of odgy shucks over a comment, and I need you to go back and kind of double click on that one. So,
okay,
highest B score in the world at 207. What makes the company so great and so strong in these areas, do you think? I mean, you know, what would get you to the 200, let alone the 207?
Well, there's several things. We really do separate the people from the job. Everyone has the same benefits, period. Vision, dental, health, life insurance. It doesn't matter if you have a GED or a PhD in our company, and it doesn't matter where you are along the org chart. It's, you have the same benefits. So everyone is valued as people. Okay. The economic reality is that not everyone's jobs warrant the same pay, but that's kind of secondary to the benefit side of it. We're very careful environmentally. We're very careful about plastic offsetting and solar power and our clean supply chain, our fair trade supply chain. It's kind of the Swiss cheese analogy where every layer has a hole in it, but if you put enough layers in it, you eventually get something that's watertight. And that's kind of where we are.
I like that. And has that always been there? Is that a historical kind of focus on the people? Or is that something that company has kind of grown into over the years as culture?
We have grown into it over the years. Actually, Dr. Bronner's son, when he took over the company in the mid-90s, Dr. Bronner's getting older, and that generation is actually the one that jump-started the employee benefits that we have now. And we've just continued to go in that direction.
What about operationally? I mean, it's very rare that you see a leader who has been in a company for 18 years. So I'm not going to worry about what it was that attracted you to Dr. Bronner's, because it was a different company 18 years ago than it is today. But what has got you to stay in an organization for that long? And then can you walk us through what your career growth has been with the company? Like, where did you start and how did you get into the COO role over time? I don't imagine you started in the COO role 18 years ago.
Well, when I started, the company had about 35 people. There were no officers. There were about three layers. You had ownership, you had some office workers, and you had production workers. And it truly was just sort of the family business that whoever had a knack for something would take over it and do that. We didn't have much of an org chart either. And so when I started, I was technically production manager. And I started because we had just bought a smaller company and we're integrating that in. A lady wanted to go do some social justice work and wanted to give her company a good home. And so she wanted us to buy it. And so we took over that. And I think the reason I've stayed is because I'm still useful. At some point, it will take a different mentality to run the place, maybe a little more polished, more corporate. But I have been able to take things from an oral culture where everything was just in people's heads to where we're approaching ISO certification. And we get more and more strategic and more just organized over the years. Like an example of that is labor revision codes. I'll just say that. I talked about that earlier. In order to sell internationally, we have to have different labels, sometimes culturally, sometimes legally, sometimes a mix. And we did not have item codes that supported that internally in our ERP system. And so I generated a template for how to track all that. So it's the idea of everything is you're reacting to everything, and then you have to genericize. And so we begin to genericize everything to which we reacted. And we kind of, why did we fail here? We do a postmortem and come up with a system. Why did we fail here? Another postmortem, another system. And so we were able to handle more and more and do it better and better. During COVID, we grew 44%.
Wow.
We shrank back down, and now we're back to where we should be just because of panic buying. But we had good enough systems, and I called two people in my office when I noticed what was happening with open orders March of that year. And I said, we need a second shift yesterday. And so we were far enough along into our ISO certification that we had enough written, and we had a full second shift within 8 business days. And it's because we just take a very slow road to self-improvement over time. And we never stop pushing and getting better is what it's.
Yeah, you may be taking a slow road, but the fact that you do a postmortem on everything and you examine kind of internally what you can then create a new systems for, I think is giving you a very systemic approach to growth, which is really powerful. How do you get the organization to do the postmortems and look at kind of examining your own contributions to the problems or examining your own missing systems without feeling like people are pointing fingers at each other and without people feeling like I did something wrong, right? Because it's never really the person's fault. It's a missing system's fault. Do you have any thoughts around that?
Yeah, it's a lot of it is cultural. And I guess the analogy that I like to use is getting people on the same side of the table. It's always the mythical, the other side of the table is whatever you're working against. And we're never working against other people. We're always working against essentially chaos because there's nothing in nature that wants the soap to go in the bottle 30,000 times a day properly. Like that's what we're facing all the time. And we have 1,100 label variants. And so we have to track all of that without having too much inventory. So to get back to that question, how do we do it? Well, first of all, they have to do it because I say they do because I run operations and that's just standard. But I think it's the way that it's asked. It's we failed here. Why did we fail? And what were the assumptions? And again, how do we genericize it? Essentially, what rules can we bring into play that we didn't have that can assuage the situation? I don't want to remove speed bumps. So what can obviate the situation? And so we just move smoothly from there.
You mentioned, COVID and how COVID had an impact, I mean, on all companies, but on I would think that for you, your company, you were fairly traditional, I'm guessing, kind of grow where you're planted. Was everybody working from one office or one city at the time? And then how did you adapt and change during COVID? And how did it make the company stronger?
Ooh, okay. Well, we are located in Vista, California, and we have a small campus, but they're all contiguous buildings. And we did send people home. A lot of the accounting staff, the sales staff, marketing staff, they started working from home, but you can't do the manufacturing process by remote control. So let's say 2/3 of the company came into the office every day. I started at the beginning by looking to current authorities and just no one knew what was going on at that time. It was very seat of the pants. So I went and got a letter from the county health department saying that they thought we were an essential business and put it on the front doors to make sure that no one came trying to shut us down, asking questions there. Again, I think that the way that we were able to do that, it slowed us down. Okay. We tested every week. We had a lot more temps, a lot more churn because a lot of people would be absent. But we kind of relied on our relationships and our internal relationships because we had a strong culture. People came and they just wanted to work and they were sort of glad for the normalcy. But then I actually got interviewed a couple of times by like CNN and Harper's because there's a very short window of a couple of weeks toward the beginning of COVID when shelves were empty and supply chains were sexy. And I thought, this is never going to happen again, the latter part of that. And so I'll give these interviews. And they said, well, how did you pivot and get supplies when everyone else can't? I said, we didn't pivot. I said, we've operated conservatively and we've built strong relationships with our suppliers and we've never been cutthroat with them. Everyone has to make money. Everyone has to want to work with each other. And so we've always worked with our suppliers that way. And so they were there for us during COVID and they've been over backwards for us. We kept them in business. We kept them in business. We very much believe in the expanding good and that business is not a zero sum game, but that when you approach each other and do business, when two parties approach each other and do business together, that there's greater good and that no one is necessarily robbed by definition there. The label maker is glad to have the business. We're glad to have the labels. Everyone wins there.
I like that approach. I like the thoughts around it. I want to ask about your growth internally. I mean, how many employees does Dr. Bronner's have today? You said there was about 35 when you started.
About 350.
So it's essentially the same company, right? 10 times bigger, everything's the same.
We're 16 times the revenue, but 10 times the workforce. So we've actually gotten a lot better. We're a lot more efficient than we used to be.
Well, and it's interesting. I was talking to a group of COOs the other day. We run an organization called the COO Alliance, and we've got COOs from 16 different countries that are members. And we were talking about operational efficiency and measuring the revenue per employee, gross margin per employee, and then revenue versus salaries as a percentage of revenue. And hey, you need to get operational efficiency, otherwise you're building complexity. And so many companies don't measure that. So yeah, to be 16 times bigger and 10 times the amount of employees, what has allowed you to do that? And what do you continue to focus on to gain operational efficiency?
Well, that's twofold. One is, I'm going to go back to it, worker value and workplace culture. Before COVID, we had about a 3% turnover rate in the company. We have about an 8% turnover now. So that's drastically different for us, 8%. But when people are around for longer, they become integral to the process. They just get better. They are around long enough to absorb the lessons that our Six Sigma, our Lean Six Sigma Black Belt has. So there's a large cultural component to that. Operationally, the larger you get, the larger machines you can buy too. And so whereas I had a machine that in our previous location that could run at about 110 bottles a minute, in this location, we greatly expanded our footprint in 2013 just because we had to, because we were growing so much. And I've been able to put in faster machines. And so whereas the fast line used to be 110 bottles a minute, now it's 240 bottles a minute. And so we strategically put in the right equipment at the right time. And we self-fund all of this. It used to be more complex. And now it's become a little simpler. And like I know about what percentage of our net rev needs to go into CapEx just to keep us growing properly. There's a point in which you can model everything in your head, and then you realize you can't model everything in your head. And then it almost becomes simple again. And after so many years, and you know, you have some heuristics on which you can rely to make things work. So to go back to the question, it's cultural because people stay a long time and they get very good at what they do. And it's assiduous use of CapEx to keep us efficient.
How do you trickle down that information, or you know, bring that information and the thoughts down to the rest of the team so that the frontline staff and operational people can see the business from that same lens that you're seeing it? How do you teach them that?
Well, we do. We try to. First of all, like right behind me, I have this 4x8 whiteboard in my office, and people get impromptu lectures more than they bargain for. If they come in and ask a question, we'll tee out things to follow the accounting. We'll look at the processes. However, but Dr. Bronner's is was family owned and operated company, and the company officers, we do what we call four square videos, and they look like the opening to the Brady Bunch, where we'll just record, and then we'll have it available for everyone, and we'll answer questions that people have. We have company meetings four times a year, and we just talk about the state of the business. I don't go into a lot of accounting abstraction. I don't think I use the terms CapEx or working cap or anything like that. But I just kind of give a state of the union for ops and how we're doing and what we're up to, because I figure that the more people know, the greater they can be involved in it. And if you believe that people are your greatest asset, then you act like that.
Mm. Talk about what it's like working inside of a family-owned company, and what are some of the strengths and weaknesses of that? And what are the differences between, I guess, maybe that org structure versus a non-family-run company? I mean, you get some of the big strengths that, you know, they care maybe more than some companies do, but then you might get the, are there many employees from within the company working at the company or within the family? I'm sorry.
There are some. There's kind of break it along generational lines. It has to do with scaling. I think that's the main issue. And when you scale just as sort of a generic corporation, you're assuming an org chart, and you're assuming that you're going to get to a place where the position can split and people are fungible and such. There's the family and the direction, that's not really fungible in a family company. The family always sets the direction. Good family management will hire people who are smarter than they are in the particular areas where they need to be and will listen. I think the most important thing for family management to understand is that you're not right simply because of your last name. It doesn't necessarily create business intel or business acumen. You have to learn that. And so what you want is a family who owns it, but who will also listen and take counsel. That sort of summarizes everything about working with a family business.
That's actually very similar to, you know, companies that might have the 65 plus year old CEOs, right? That in the 70s and 80s, it was because I said so, and, you know, it's my way or the highway. That just doesn't fly anymore. How has the company had to change because it's been around for, you know, almost 100, or how many years has it been around now? 80 years, 70?
Well, 2023 marked our technical 75th anniversary. It's arguable that the family invented liquid soap in Laupheim, Germany in 1858. And so it's fifth generation, maybe it's third generation, depending on how you look at it. It was Dr. Bronner. Okay. Dr. Bronner ran the company because of the moral ABC as a religious nonprofit for a while. He tried to. And then in the early 70s, the IRS put a stop to that. They said, no, you're a for-profit business. And whatever Dr. Bronner said was true. Okay. Then his son and his son's wife and another son came in and took over, and they started to normalize the business, I would say. They're the ones that brought the benefits and such. And now the third generation, Dr. Bronner's grandsons, own and run it. And they have positions and an org chart and a real HR department. And they listen to what HR says, saying, yes, you can do this. No, you can't. They don't just walk over prudence there. We have in-house counsel now, and they listen to in-house counsel. So structurally, the company has grown from a small family business into a small corporation that is still run by family.
Hmm. All right. So the company has adapted and changed because of COVID. You've adapted and changed. Yeah, because of growth, you know, the 10x growth, 16x growth on revenue, you've adapted and changed. How have you as a leader had to grow? I mean, starting off as a production manager and then now as COO, where have you had to continue to grow your skills over the years?
What I have, I think the most important lesson I have learned is that if you're leading something, you primarily need to be a generalist and secondarily a technologist. It used to be that I ordered machines and I knew how to do that. And it used to be that I would order, that I would write purchase orders and I would receive purchase orders and things like that. I don't do any of that anymore. I personally have abstracted my role into something fairly simple. I actually sat down to do my, to write a job description last year. And I thought, what is my job description? And I, and from a tactical standpoint, I went through the cost of goods sheet and part of the G&A schedule, and it was 5 pages single-spaced. Tactically, all the things for which I'm responsible. Do I think like that? Well, yes and no. But my job description is a mandate, and it's protect the revenue, protect the cash, and protect the margins in that order. And it's kind of an odd order, but protect the revenue. Why? Because if you're not on the shelf, people can't buy you. And if you're not on the shelf for a very long time, you get kicked out and it's very hard to fight back. And because we think it's better to use our products, we always wanted to be there, especially during COVID. We wanted our quarter peppermint to be the last man standing. Whatever else happened in the world, you could go into the store and buy a quarter of Dr. Bronner's. So we have this ersatz 100% service level commitment to our end customers so they can always get our product. Sometimes we violate the margin idea in order to do that, but long term, margins don't matter if you don't have revenue. And the cash is in the middle, okay, because, and that's a lot, that has to do with inventory management. It's very easy to run an inventory fearfully and buy too much. And then suddenly, if I'm running a $40 million inventory and I listen to my gut too much, I could overspend by $4 or $6 million in a year. And we project much, much tighter than that. And I can't do that. Every single inventory item has its own risk signature and its own appropriate envelope for min and max. And so that's part of the protecting the cash. But I didn't think systemically like this. I mean, when I got to the business, I came in, I just scrambled, did the best I could. I earned my MBA during those early years and helped me with the accounting knowledge and such. So now I'm a generalist that focuses on operations, and that there are tactical skills that I don't deploy anymore that I used to. And there are tactical skills that I do deploy whose existence I wasn't even aware at the time when I started.
I've got a tactical question for you on the growth of the organization and the size that you're at. And it's, how do you decide what parts of the business to keep internal, and how do you decide what parts of the business to outsource and hire, you know, suppliers or partners to do? I mean, like Apple, you know, designs and markets an iPhone, but they don't make the iPhone. Are there parts of the business that Dr. Bronner's outsources, and and how do you decide which parts of the business to do that?
Okay, so I mentioned earlier the idea that we're kind of centered set in our ideology, but I didn't explore what that means. We're always trying to get to something, and we're always trying to do business with the most amount of collateral good. And because we're a fair trade certified company, that means that everyone in our value chain makes a decent living, can take care of family and kids, can just approach life with dignity. And that's the idea. And so we try to insource everything as much as we can. And it's because we want to be able to include as many people as possible in this fair trade family. Okay, Our toothpaste, we outsource that. Our hand sanitizer, we outsource that because you have to be FDA drug certified. And that is a very heavy transactional load in order to make some minor product lines. We don't really need to be FDA certified to make soap. It's the stakes aren't that high. And so we have stayed away from that. There are some places, there are a couple of things that have some specialized equipment and we haven't taken that in-house yet. But like, for instance, small packaging in an industrial scale, when you have huge analog machines, you make pallets of product very efficiently. A lot of people send that out if they have to do special holiday packs. And we were doing that sort of thing. And we were looking at what the company was paying, the outsourcing company. And I thought, wow, we need to bring this in-house. Well, no one takes better care of us than us. We were always looking out for our own interest the best. And so we're always at the front of our list. We're not always at the front of everyone else's queue for getting work done. But the real reason why we spool up a department for that sort of thing is so that we would honor our fair trade ideals and thus fulfill our brand promise in the world.
It makes sense. And if you're always focused on that brand promise and your ideals and kind of the core of why you exist, it's easy to make those decisions then too.
So an ancillary here, just how do you do that? How can you afford? We have a 5-to-1 pay cap. So execs don't make more than 5 times what a fully vested line worker makes. That's not a temp worker, but someone who's been there for 5 years. We want to encourage longevity, and therefore you get fully vested over 5 years. So yeah, we maintain a 5-to-1 ratio, and the delta between 5-to-1 and 300-to-1, you can buy a lot of employee benefits with that and treat the general populace a lot better.
Yeah, you really can. It makes sense as to why you guys are rated as high as you are on the B Corp side of things too. All right, I want you to go back to the 22-year-old Michael Milam and give yourself some advice. What advice would you give the younger you that you know to be true today?
I would say the way that you process and how you think is good enough, and you don't have to look to other people for answers all the time. You can figure things out. That's pretty important. And I actually say that to my managers too. I say, all the answers we need are in this room. You just have to figure them out. Yeah. And that's, I call that expertitis, that people get scared of their own thoughts. They get scared of owning the consequences of their thoughts. And so they want a hired gun, maybe not to get the best results, but it essentially is a group CYA maneuver. So don't do that. The other is, I don't know where I saw this recently. This is not my thought, so I want to give credit to whoever said it, even though I can't remember who it was. But there's a lot of careers that are paint-by-numbers schemes. Like, and you do exactly what you should do. Well, you do exactly what's said, and you get the product that you meant to have. But the true masterpieces begun with a terrifyingly white canvas with no implied direction other than what's in your head. And I would say to my 22-year-old self, don't be scared of that. Go with the process and make it up as you go along. Things turn out incredibly well on the macro scale if you do the right things in the micro scale on a day-to-day basis, and you don't have to look over your shoulder, you know.
I love it. Michael Milam, the COO for Dr. Bronner's. Thanks so much for sharing with us on the Second in Command podcast.
Hi, you're welcome.
You've been listening to Second in Command, brought to you by COO Alliance founder Cameron Harold. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to like, share, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our other podcast streaming platforms. For more best practices from industry-leading COOs, visit COOalliance.com.